Going to begin, as I find I far too often do, with a round of apologies. I suppose it's not good form to begin by apologizing for the talk you're about to begin, but that seems to be my way. I'll start with this apology. I was originally scheduled, as you know, to speak on Saturday, and I had really been counting on that time to finish my slides. So I did make what I think is a good effort to get everything in shape last night. But I make no very great promises for the coherence of the slides. I can't even promise that the notation will be consistent from slide to slide. I'll try to sort of indicate how things ought to go in cases where that's not how they appear. The other apology that I need to make is for my title, which is really a kind of bait and switch title. 4.5 axioms sort of suggests, of course, that I'm trying to do Lucian, if not one better than half a notch better, by proposing fewer axioms or maybe as many axioms, but one of them maybe is going to be a little weaker or somehow a little bit more attractive than one of Lucian's. But that's not what I mean. In fact, the half axiom of my title refers to a postulate that is mathematically very simple, but that I really don't have a clue at the moment as to how to motivate. So in fact, in some sense, it's strong. As Bob was saying to me last night at the Jane Bond, it's an infinite axiom. It's 4.5 is 4 plus infinity. So 4 plus omega. So all right, so with apologies out of the way, one of these, here's how I'm going to try to structure the talk. I'm going to begin with some general background and motivation. I guess motivation is another word for further apologies, but, well, maybe not. So motivation, but also some background. Then I'm going to give you a kind of quick tutorial on one of several different mathematical frameworks that one can use to talk about what I guess I'll call general probability theory, some sort of very general, conceptually innocent extension of classical probability theory that's sufficiently broad to encompass classical probability theory, quantum probability theory, and anything else that you might entertain, and yet sufficiently innocent that one isn't going to have any particular question with any of its axioms. That sort of framework is the kind of framework in which I think one needs to work if one is going to ask questions about the origins or the meaning, the content of the particular probabilistic apparatus that we use in quantum mechanics. I think you need a little altitude in order to be able to address any concerns you might have about that formalism. And there is a fairly standard way of approaching this general probability theory with a lot of little idiomatic variations. And so for those who already are familiar with this, this is kind of an introduction to the idiom that I'm going to want to use, but many of you won't be familiar with it. So for you, it will just be an introduction to general probability theory per se. With all of that out of the way, I'm then going to impose a series of axioms, the ones I mentioned, which perhaps, if I'm lucky and I haven't made any ghastly errors, will lead us not quite to quantum mechanics. So this is another respect in which my title is misleading. It should really have been 4 plus infinity axioms almost for quantum mechanics. We almost get there. Where we're going to find ourselves at the end is with a formally real finite dimensional Jordan algebra. And of course the Jordan von Neumann-Wigner classification of those tells us that with two conspicuous exceptions, those do look like real complex or quaternionic quantum mechanics, if we're allowed to call real and quaternionic quantum mechanics quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's the outline. Let's start with a little bit of motivation. I think that there are two ways that one can be puzzled about quantum mechanics. It's taken me a long time to sort of come to this point of view, but it's helped me to understand perhaps some of the reason why it sometimes feels difficult for me to communicate with other people who are also doing foundational work in quantum theory. I think it comes down to the fact that there are, in fact, two different ways to be puzzled by the theory. And they're kind of dual ways to be puzzled by the theory. From one point of view, if you are coming to quantum mechanics for the first time, but with a certain mathematical background, The formal apparatus looks extremely familiar. If you take any sort of traditional course in, sort of linear PDEs or something like this, you meet Hilbert spaces right away. They're spaces typically of solutions to linear partial differential equations. Very frequently, the dynamics that those equations model get to be implemented by unitary operators on that Hilbert space. If you think about the theory of classical theory of the heat equation, the diffusion equation, that's just how it works. So from that point of view, quantum mechanics looks like a very familiar mathematical representation of a dynamical theory of a familiar kind, but with something novel and very mysterious added, and that's the probabilistic interpretation. Right? The probabilistic interpretation doesn't seem to sit very well with or very naturally with that dynamical apparatus. Now, there's another way that you can look at quantum mechanics, which I guess maybe is a natural one if you have a slightly different mathematical background coming to the theory. And that is that probabilistic apparatus, what do I mean by that? I mean the idea that measurement outcomes are positive operators, and that the probability of outcome represented by operator A in a state represented by density operator rho is traced A rho. That apparatus looks formally rather like some kind of extension of classical probability theory. The positive operators, they form a nice linear space. You can add them and do certain other things. You can compute expected values in the usual way. They behave rather like random variables, very much so if you have several that commute, but even so. And you're simply, seem to be simply assigning probabilities to these. So it is natural to think that perhaps what you have here is some sort of extension of classical probability theory, maybe adapted to the possibility that you can't measure everything simultaneously. And that's a very old point of view about quantum mechanics. If you take that second point of view, what's mysterious, though, is the formal apparatus itself. You have to ask yourself, why should measurement outcomes be encoded in this funny way? If you know that, if you can answer that question, a lot of other questions get answered automatically, mostly courtesy of Gleason's theorem, which tells us that the density operators give the only reasonable way to assign probabilities if measurement outcomes are so encoded. But why they should be so encoded, that seems rather mysterious. And of course, there's a very, very long history of people trying to answer that question, trying to give some motivation for that representation of measurement outcomes in some more or less a priori way. I think that point of view is already implicit in von Neumann's work, but it certainly becomes explicit in the work in the late 50s and early 60s of George Mackey. I've always liked this quote, which I think frames an attitude that I still find helpful. One would like to find some sort of list of physically plausible, reasonably well-motivated assumptions from which one could deduce that representation. But, even short of that, it would probably be enough if one could just get close, if one could get some sort of a short list of possibilities, of alternatives, with this being one, and with the others being in some sense, sort of manifestly inconsistent with what we see in the lab. So it's not necessary to try to derive quantum mechanics, completely from absolutely transparent a priori axioms. If you can get close that way, there's still room, for a certain amount of empirical input. I think that's a perfectly reasonable attitude. It's also an apology, because of course I'm not going to get you all the way there. I'm only going to get you a short list of alternatives. Okay, so let me introduce a little bit of technical apparatus that I'm going to need to refer to later. Mackey himself wrote down a list of axioms for a generalized probability theory, and what I'll show you a little bit later is a kind of as a framework is sort of a latter-day descendant of that. The part of Mackey's axiomatic that's relatively unproblematic leads to a representation of any probabilistic model in terms of a convex set of states, which I'm going to call omega later in the slides. There's then a cone of positive multiples of states. Those down here you can think of as subnormalized states. That sits in a nice vector space ordered by this positive cone. there's a dual cone in which the objects that represent measurement outcomes live, and that's all very clean. And I'm going to want to refer to that sort of structure. So let's quickly review some terminology associated with the notion of a cone in a real vector space. A cone in a real vector space, called the vector space A, is a, for my purposes, a closed, many people look at open cones, but I'll say a closed subset K of A that's closed under scaling by positive reals, right? If you're in the cone and you scale by a positive real, you stay in the cone. It's got to be closed under addition. If I have two things in the cone and I add them, I stay in the cone. And I also want my cones to be what are sometimes called pointed cones or proper cones. I want it to be the case that the cone intersects its mirror image under the taking of negatives, its negative image, just in zero. So zero belongs to the cone, and zero is the only thing that's both in the cone and equal to minus something in the cone. If you have that much, you can impose a partial order on the ambient vector space. You declare that one vector, A is less than or equal to another vector B, if the vector that is their difference sits in the positive cone. You call it the positive cone in that case. I'm going to make the following standing assumption in everything that I talk about today. When I say ordered linear space or ordered vector space, I always mean a real vector space with a distinguished positive cone that satisfies these conditions and is also generating. By generating, I mean that the cone actually spans the vector space it's embedded in. That's a fairly innocent assumption because, of course, if there's something that isn't in the span, you can throw it away. You can cut down on the span of the cone. I'll make another standing assumption, and here again, you see it's an illustration of just what a sleazy character I am. I'm offering you 4.5 axioms to quantum mechanics when, in fact, what I really mean is 4 plus infinity axioms that get you almost all the way to finite dimensional quantum mechanics. All spaces are finite dimensional. I'm a modest man. I'm happy if we can get even close to finite dimensional quantum mechanics, which I already find deeply mysterious. In fact, I find the whole region around it deeply mysterious. I don't think seesaw algebraic models of generalized probability theory are at all clearly motivated. I don't think Jordan algebraic models are clearly motivated, except by virtue of what I'm going to say today. It's all been a mystery. Yes. Only if you can show me that sort of principled way A to put those together in the usual way, so that I can build other things out of them. So you have to motivate the Hilbert. Yes.
One non-trivial.
Yes, I think so. I think you need to be able to compose things. And I'd also say that I'd want the motivation to be reasonably general. That is to say, if you give me a motivation that says for some particular experiment, the right model is a Q-trit, that's already pretty good. I'd be kind of happy with that, although I can kind of see how that might go in certain cases. But quantum mechanics, offers itself as our most general theory of the world, or at least it sometimes offers itself that way. And it is certainly the most general extension of classical probability theory that actually finds application. So you'd like whatever motivation you have for it to be quite general as well. So, in other words, if you're going to give me a little optical bench model and get, a Q-trit, I might want something a little bit more. Okay. All right. Okay, is everybody reasonably happy so far with what a cone is or an ordered vector space is? Okay, good. So let's talk about some particular properties that a positive cone might have. But before we introduce those properties, one further basic notion. If you have a cone K, you can introduce a cone, a natural cone called the dual cone, that lives in the dual space of the ambient space A. So if K is a cone in space A, then you define the dual cone K star to be the collection of functionals F in the dual space A star that take positive values on elements of the positive cone, on elements of K. Easy to check that is, in fact, a nice cone. Now, if, great, well, it's helpful to know the Hanbanach theorem, but, otherwise it's easy to check. If A carries an inner product, so that we can identify A with its dual. Remember here that everything's finite dimensional, so an inner product is essentially an identification of A with its dual. Then you can sort of internalize that construction. You define what I'll call the internal dual of K relative to that inner product to be this creature K upper plus, which is the set of vectors B in A, such that the inner product of B with A is positive for all elements of, for all, that should be A, for all A in the cone. And of course, that is isomorphic to the dual cone. Now, here's a non-trivial property that a cone may enjoy. We say that a cone is self-dual, or self-dual relative to an inner product, but I'll just say self-dual if there is an inner product relative to which this happens, namely that K equals this internal dual. Now, let me give you a very quick picture to illustrate how this can happen or fail to happen, maybe just in two dimensions. Suppose that we have an ambient R2, and suppose that we take as our cone, somewhere there was a brown, moved it over here, okay? Suppose we take as our cone something that looks like this. There's some angle there. Okay, so that's my cone K. Now, what would the internal dual be? It would be the set of vectors. So here would be contained in K plus. By the same token, if we started with K, I don't need to impose a basis. It is always true that if I have a generating cone, I can pick a basis that sits inside the cone, and maybe I can pick all the vectors to be along extreme rays of the cone and so on. But I'm not sure that that's going to be very. Maybe in some cases that's a useful thing to do, but I don't think it's necessary here. So maybe I shouldn't have even drawn the coordinate system. Okay. Very quickly, who can tell me? How should I make it self-dual? I want a K to line up with K plus. Yeah, I just make this angle 90 degrees, right? Quadrant of R. There is a sense in which, at least in finite dimensions, you want to think of self-dual cones as those that open at 90 degrees. At least that's a rough intuition that one can begin with. Now, here's one example of a self-dual cone, as well as some that aren't. Here's a more interesting example from our point of view. If you look at the cone of positive operators in a finite dimensional Hilbert space H, I always feel a little bit ashamed of myself when I say something like finite dimensional Hilbert space, but everybody seems to be doing it, so I will too. Okay, if you look at the cone of positive operators therein, with the usual trace inner product, that's self-dual, right? An operator is positive if and only if its trace with any other positive operator is positive. Okay, so that's a property that not every cone has, but that the cone that we're particularly interested in does. Now, let me just emphasize, this is the cone where the things that represent quantum mechanical measurement outcomes live. Quantum mechanical measurement outcomes live in a cone, this one. And it has this one special property. Okay, so we take note of that. Here's another special property that this cone has that most cones do not. Let's call a cone homogeneous if given any pair of points, not just anywhere in the cone, but in the interior of the cone, not on the boundary of the cone. Any two points in the interior. Oh, thank you. That's what I get for talking too much. Excuse me, I have to go back and take care of this. I have to remember my password. It's not that I don't remember it, but my fingers are sometimes, you know, a little clumsy. If I have this, I can click back and forth, and maybe that will satisfy it. So a cone is homogeneous if given any two points in the interior of the cone, there's always an automorphism of the cone. That means an affine bijective mapping from the cone to itself. Affine means preserves convex combinations. We want an affine automorphism of the cone that takes A to B. So another way to say this, a slightly fancier way to say this, is that a cone is homogeneous if the group of affine automorphisms of that cone acts transitively on the cone's interior, so that all points in the interior, in some sense, look the same up to the action of that group. If you have a cone that has a circular cross-section, like this one, it's not too difficult to convince yourself that that is homogeneous. If you have a cone with a less symmetrical and mounted at the origin, that that's not by half of that cone. The cone that interests us, however, is homogeneous. That should be L plus, the positive cone of Hermitian operators is homogeneous, and you can prove that for yourself, treat it as an exercise, but use the spectral theorem. If you have two points interior to that cone, the fact that they're interior means that in their spectral decomposition, the eigenvalues are all non-zero, and by doing a little scaling exercise, you can see how to construct an automorphism that can match one to the other. In fact, I'll show you a version of that same argument a little bit later. Yes? No, it's actually important, for me rhetorically, it's very important that you should have no good physical intuition about homogeneity. It should seem mysterious.
Okay.
Does that help?
Maybe it's more than I'm not really understanding the definition.
Ah, okay.
So in the circular case, I'm thinking, you know, I can shrink the circle, so I could give me a point near the center and a point near the edge,
right.
And you say, what's the best center, I can take the circle and shrinking it and maybe rotating it, and that's not fine.
That would be, however, not an automorphism of the cone, because you want something that's bijective, something that's reversible. So for that, what you need to be able to do is tilt the cross section in nice ways, okay, and then move it up and down and rotate it. And by doing things like that, I don't. Maybe I was saying, maybe when I said you can show that that's homogeneous, I was inadvertently giving you the idea that that's totally trivial to check. I wouldn't say it's totally trivial to check. But you can check it, okay? This is what I wanted to say, which is his question. I thought that's what he was asking. The answer is yes, but I haven't told you what it is yet. And the talk will be the more remarkable, striking, illuminating, et cetera, the more mysterious you find this. Okay, okay, quickly. That notation is a misprint. Well, in a way, it's my notation for the Hermitian operators on H for Hermitian, but I really wanted L plus, the positive operators, so it's also a typo. Okay. Yes?
If it's structured to have the probability,
yes. Well, it seems to me that the observed, well, okay, so let's talk about that part of the cone that represents the observables. Reasonable thing to do at this point. Let me erase some. This is going to be a very sort of metaphorical, you know, figurative sort of illustration. I can't draw the cone L plus for you in any persuasive way. But I'll draw a little two-dimensional. This is L. Okay, this is the cone of positive operators. Yes, the identity operator, which represents a trivial effect that always has probability 1 in any state. Any positive operator, you use a positive operator that gets probabilities between 0 and 1 when you trace with a state, and that's element the identity. Darn it, the set of effects, right, is, it already spans the cone. Everything in the cone, if you look at the set of density operators, that's across, cuts across like that. That thing is uniquely a multiple of a density operator. Things are always multiples, but not uniquely of effects, right? I can set down a different effect. But Actually, Howard on Saturday will have a great deal more to say, I think, about this picture. Okay, so there we are. Now, I want to talk about these two properties, self-duality and homogeneity. They're really very strong properties, indeed. And if you combine them, if you ask what cones get to be both self-dual and homogeneous, at least in finite dimensions, the answer is not very many. There's this wonderful theorem, actually originally first published by Kircher, and then a few years later, I guess, independently by Vinberg, the upshot of which is that if you have a finite-dimensional homogeneous self-dual cone, it's isomorphic to the positive cone of a formally real Jordan algebra. Now, without writing down, you know, sort of the axiomatic definition of a formally real Jordan algebra, I'll just appeal to a much older result, which is the classification of such formally real Jordan algebras by Jordan, Weil, and von Neumann in the early 30s, very much in an effort to reconstruct or motivate or derive quantum mechanics from more physically plausible axioms. The theorem says that formally real Jordan algebras are all direct sums of irreducible formally real Jordan algebras, which must in turn be one of the following types, thinking of them here as cones, or the positive cones of which must be one of the following types. Either you're looking at positive Hermitian matrices over the real, the complexes, or the quaternions, or you're looking at cones, n-dimensional ball-shaped cross-sections, things like this or higher-dimensional analogs of them. Those are sometimes called spin factors in the literature. And of course, there's one case, if your cross-section is a three-dimensional ball, where that's quantum mechanics. That's the qubit, yes? All of those show up in this classification. And then there's one further example. It turns out that the positive 3x3 Hermitians over the octonions are also the positive cone of a formally real Jordan algebra. So we have more or less what we want, plus two additional entries in one book on Jordan algebra that I like very much. They're called The Uninvited Guests. And this one is uninvited, but it seems, you know, still, you know, reasonably acceptable, presentable at least. And then there's this fellow that you don't know how to ask to leave, but you really would just leave. Of course, a very, very interesting example mathematically, with you know, deep connections to all sorts of things all over mathematics. But from our point of view, not at all what we thought we ordered. However, I do want to point out that this is a short list of candidates. And if we can find some way to either physically or otherwise eliminate, or who knows, perhaps make room for the spin factors, and probably eliminate, people have tried to make room for, but it seems safer just to eliminate the weird exceptional example there, then we will have quantum mechanics, at least quantum mechanics over possibly some strange division rings. But, you know, as I said at the beginning, I'm not that picky. Okay? So, here's the idea. If I can give you some sort of reasonably physical motivation, or probabilistic motivation, for these properties of homogeneity and self-duality, then I come pretty close to motivating quantum mechanics. That's the idea that I'm going to work with. Now, I want to say a little bit more about this word motivate. That's a tricky word. One person's motivation is another person's, you know, ad hoc, you know, lousy, worthless axiom, unworthy of the name, right? One of mine will be kind of like that, but the others I think are okay. But saying that they're okay is not to say that they are weak. It's not to say that they are totally, sort of innocent, a priori pap, right? They're axioms with some punch. What I think makes them reasonable in this context is that I believe that in each case the axiom says something that one can understand in physical or probabilistic or perhaps information theoretic terms. In other words, I think the point is not that axioms necessarily need to be weak, though that's better if you can achieve it. I think the real requirement for axioms that will do the job that we're wanting them to do is that their content be clear, that they be intelligible. not just as mathematics, but as statements about some sort of putative physical or probabilistic system. And I hope that 4 out of my 4.5 axioms have that character. Now, at this point, I've finished the sort of motivational part of the talk. I'm about halfway done. So I may try to speed up a little bit, but I am going to take a risk and ask at this point if at this point everybody's happy or if there are any questions. Okay, I'll take that as a yes and a no, respectively. Let me give you some language. Let's establish a framework for talking about probabilistic theories in general. I want to remain fairly elementary. I think saying, as one sometimes does, and sometimes very usefully, well, the set of states should be a convex set, and then you can build a cone out of that, and so on, that maybe is a little too abstract for my purposes. So let's start with something more elementary. The most basic version of classical probability theory is one in which you have a finite set of mutually exclusive outcomes, the outcomes of some experiment, like flipping a coin or rolling a die or picking somebody, you know, out of an urn. Or, I'm sorry, picking somebody out of a room. That's right. If you're picked out of an urn, you really hope it's not with replacement. So that's straightforward and presumably unproblematic. Finite outcome set, and of course then you put probability weights on that. You assign real numbers to outcomes, they add up to 1. They're non-negative. Non-negative probabilities adding up to 1 over all the outcomes. So here's a very simple way to generalize that. Instead of taking just one outcome set corresponding to one measurement, just allow yourself to have many different measurements, which might be in some sense incompatible. Maybe you have a choice to, you know, flip the coin or roll the die, but I won't let you do both. Okay? That's a very simple idea. Let's agree to call a collection of non-empty sets understood as outcome sets for several different experiments a test space. The individual sets, the outcome sets for the various measurements, I'll call tests. Okay, fair enough. That's a test space, just a collection of perfectly ordinary, you know, freshman stat outcome sets. And I'll use Fraktur A or Fraktur B to indicate such a collection. Here's some further notation and jargon to go along with this idea. If I have a test space Fraktur A, I will consider sometimes want to consider all of the outcomes of all of the measurements in that collection, sort of just thrown indiscriminately into a big pile. That pile I will call capital X and call it the total outcome space. So for example, if my test space is flip a coin or roll a die, then the total outcome space would be heads, tails, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Right? But that's not the outcome space of one experiment. It's the union of the outcome spaces of two experiments. All right, here's what I mean by a probability weight on a test space with total outcome space X. I mean a mapping, let's call it alpha generically, that assigns to every outcome of every experiment, or every test, a number between 0 and 1, so that these numbers add up to 1 independently over each test. Now, what makes this a fairly strong constraint is that I have not said that distinct tests must have distinct sets of outcomes. I want to allow, which is more general, you know, more general to allow for this, that distinct experiments might possibly share outcomes. So for instance, I might have a test space which, I'll explain the diagrammatic convention in a minute, consists of 2 outcome sets outside the dots along the line if they are alternative outcomes of a single experiment. So I might have 2 distinct experiments, this one outcome in common. And there are lots of reasons why you might want to identify outcomes from different experiments. I won't pursue that right now, but afterwards, if you're curious, please ask. What do I mean by a probability weight on this? Well, I mean an assignment of numbers between 0 and the 5 nodes that will add across the top to be the same whether experiment. So in the language of the day, a probability weight is a non-contextual probability assignment, probabilities to measurement outcomes. It's strong constraint to say that there are any of these. Anybody very quickly tell me what the probability weights on that are in more familiar language? Right, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tests. Bistochastic 3x3 matrices, okay? Nice convex set. There's the, well, the bistochastic 3x4 matrices, of which there are clearly none, right? I can't have 4. So there are no states on that. So it's a constraint on a collection of sets that there should be any probability weights. But given our intended interpretation, of course, we want there to be a lot of probability weights. Right? Test space is not very much use if it doesn't have any. All right, I will frequently write omega of fracture A for the set of all probability weights on script A. This is the state space of the test space. Okay? It, by the way, is clearly convex, right? I mean, it's clear from this definition that if I average two such maps, I get another such map. If the tests are individually finite sets, which I haven't assumed here, but soon will, then you can show that this is actually a compact convex set in an appropriate weak topology, even in infinite dimensions. Okay, let's look at a couple of quick examples. One I've already mentioned, a classical model. Oh, actually, you know what? I seem to have, there's a missing bullet here. So let me just stop for a very quick minute. Is everybody comfortable with the notion of a test space and a probability weight thereon? Hopefully that seems very elementary. Well, entities are actually, they have a little more structure. We can talk about that after. More simple idea. Sometimes, probably a fracture, so I'll use this sort of big lima bean shaped script A as a test. Sometimes, in all of the probability weights, sometimes you have some reason given by your model to want to restrict the set of states. Maybe some states don't seem very physical or very relevant to your model. So it's consider test spaces together. I will say always compact, convex sets of states. I will allow this to be a proper subset of the space of all states on the test space. So I'm going to use omega generically, not but possibly for smaller convex sets that you've singled out as the physically reasonable probabilistic model. That should have been right here on the slide. I'm not quite sure what happened to it. Okay. So let's look at some models. There are classical models. And the simplest classical model is the classical model in which we have fracture A being just a singleton, that is to say, a single set. It comprises just a single set. There's one experiment with, therefore, one outcome set. Maybe it's finite, just to make this extremely simple. And we could plausibly take, in this case, omega to be the entire simplex of probability weights, of all probability weights on that set. Or in some context, we might want to restrict it. Maybe we're interested in some statistical model in which the set of states is restricted somehow. But for my purposes, it'll be OK to look at all of them. What about quantum models? Well, we could let fracture A be any of a number of things. I mean, we could conceivably let it be all possible positive operator valued measures, maybe discrete positive operator valued measures. Where I guess I would have to insist that the P of the M elements are all distinct in order to have a set instead of a multi-set. But rather than doing that, I'll look at something that's very small, but still sufficient. Let's let fracture A be the set of orthonormal bases of a Hilbert space H, the sort of naive model of quantum mechanical measurement that you might meet in your first QM textbook. We can let omega, which sometimes I'll call omega of H, be the set of states of the usual form, quadratic forms associated with density operators. It's noteworthy that Gleason's theorem tells us that actually all states on this thing have this form. There are no other states that I've excluded, except in dimension 2. And so in dimension 2, I'd want to place a restriction on the set of states. Okay. Now, if I had a little more time, I would show you, I don't know, a whole bunch of other examples, because it's really fun to look at crazy examples in this formalism. So if you're feeling, I don't know, you know, like you'd want something a little bit more exotic and entertaining, again, afterwards ask me and I will draw examples for you. But I need to proceed. One thing that I should say, it's going to be quite important, is that this apparatus of test spaces and convex sets of probability weights, convex sets of states they're on, can be linearized in a very nice way. If you give me a model with a total outcome space X, you can let V of the set of states be the span in R to the X of that state space. You get something that kind of looks like this picture. You order it pointwise on the outcome set. That gives you a positive cone. You know, things are positive if they're positive as functions on X. Omega is a base for this cone, as in this picture. That means everything is a unique multiple of a normalized state in that cone. In the quantum model, you get exactly the Hermitian operators this way, right? If you look at the span of the density operators as quadratic forms on the unit sphere, which would be our X, you get a model of the Hermitian operators with the usual ordering. Of course, this space has a dual space with a dual cone. Let's call that the star. The dual ordering, just to remind you, is that a functional f is dually positive if it gives you positive values on every positive element of V. But since every positive element of V is uniquely a multiple of a normalized state, we might as well say it this way. Functionals are positive if they're positive on states. There's a natural embedding of outcomes in these functionals. Let's say X goes to X hat. Just given by evaluation. I can say x hat of the state alpha is alpha at x. X hat of alpha is the probability of outcome x in state alpha. If you add up all the x hats over the x's belonging to a test, you always get the same thing. You get one, right, uniformly, when you evaluate at a state. So if you hold off evaluating at the state, adding up these x hats gives you a functional, which I'll call u, the so-called order unit functional, the unit functional, which is the unique functional that takes the constant value 1 on the normalized states. And again, in quantum mechanics, because of the self-duality of the cone, you again get the Hermitian operators. Now I'm ready for my axioms. I have 15 minutes left to tell you about my axioms. I guess this maybe is another example of sleazy behavior. Okay. Here's my first axiom. My first axiom is not very strong. It almost doesn't deserve the name on the basis of weakness rather than superfluous strength. Superabundance is true. I want there to be a lot of states. So let's agree that a set of states, convex set of states omega, is separating if the mapping from X to this evaluation functional X hat is injective. That just means if two outcomes have the same probability in every state, they're the same outcome. Skipping down here, that's an axiom of convenience, because if not, you would just replace X with X hat anyway. Throughout the talk, I'm going to do that, right? Just as a convenience. If I say X, I'm not going to really distinguish between these two gadgets. So from now on, outcomes live in this dual cone. Another thing that's nice is if omega be unital. What that means is that for every outcome, there's at least one state that gives it probability 1. That's kind of a way of saying that you can prepare. You can prepare something with that outcome. If you know the outcome, you know, is going to occur or has occurred, if you condition on the outcome, there's some state that is consistent with that. Okay. Now, I'm going to move along to a much, much stronger axiom, a much more interesting axiom. Let's talk about symmetries of the test space. If I have a group, G, then I'm going to say my test space A is a G test space if there's given an action of that group on the total outcome space that permutes the tests, right? So that G, little g, an element of the group applied to the set E gives you, where E is a test, gives you another test. That makes sense? Right? You permute the outcomes in such a way that if you were looking at a test, after the permutation, you're still looking at a test. That's the natural notion of a symmetry for a test space. So G test space is a test space equipped with an action of the group G by symmetries. I'm going to say that a G test space is fully symmetric if that action has the following two very strong transitivity properties. The first is, I want all tests to have the same size. The second is, I want it to be the case that if you have any bijection between two tests, match up two tests any way you want, there should be at least one group element, one element of G, that implements that bijection. So the idea here is that if you think of this as a combination of two things. One, if I look at a single test and I permute its outcomes, I should be able to do that physically, not just on paper. There should be a physical symmetry that does that for me. That's kind of a way of saying that at least from that point of view, if I just look at one test, things look pretty classical. Classically, I can permute things physically. And actually, quantum mechanics too, right, using unitaries. But I want to make that part of my axiomatic framework. I also want it to be the case that if I have two tests, they look the same. I can map one to the other by a symmetry operation. The combination of those conditions is the same as this. Yeah, but it wouldn't necessarily, I could. I mean, if there is a group that does this trick, the automorphism group will also do this trick. But I want to allow for the possibility that I might want to focus on some smaller group of symmetries. I mean, partly for this reason. I mean, if I want to know what are all of the symmetries of the set of orthonormal bases, I have to use Wigner's theorem, and there's all sorts of anti-unitary junk, and it's just cleaner if I ignore that and say that this is fully symmetric under the unitary group. Because, of course, every bijection between two orthonormal bases determines, in fact, a unique unitary that implements it. Okay. So here's my next axiom. This is a strong axiom, but I think its meaning is reasonably clear. I want to say that we're interested in systems with lots of symmetry. Before I run through the axiom, just, does this, by the way, have a pointer on it? I see it. Ah, wonderful, yeah. So I want to note that if G is acting on fracture A as before, if it's permuting the tests, then it also acts on the state space. It acts on the full state space. That should be omega of A. By the usual contragradient action, namely G of state alpha evaluated at X is just alpha evaluated at G inverse of X, the usual thing. Right? If a group acts on a set, it also acts on functions on that set. If omega is a restricted state space, part of a model, and that restricted state space is invariant under this action, then I'll say that G acts on the model. So here's my second axiom. I want to say that there's a group, not just any old group, I want it to be a compact group. We could say more about that, but I think I can motivate that. I think that when you're dealing with finite dimensional discrete systems, it's natural to assume that the symmetry groups are compact. I want it to act continuously on this thing. The continuity means mostly continuously on omega, in such a way that it acts fully symmetrically on the tests and transitively on the extreme states. Okay? Transitive action on pure states, that's similar to, I almost zapped you. I held off at the moment. It's similar to one of Lucien's axioms. Yes, Joachim. I believe they're independent. No, because there could be there could be pure states that are not assigning probability one to anything, as witness the things we were talking about in the bus. Okay. All right. So this is a strong axiom, but it has some content that I think I understand. It's an homogeneity axiom. It says everything looks the same. Pure states all look the same. All measurements look the same. All outcomes of a given measurement look the same. Obviously, classical test spaces satisfy this axiom very trivially with regard to the symmetric group and quantum test spaces with regard to the unitary group. Now, I'm going to call an inner product on V star. Let's remember V star is the dual of the span of the normalized state space. It's the linear space in which the measurement outcomes live. I'm going to call an inner product on that positive if it gives me a positive value when I evaluate it at positive elements. If the inner product is positive on the positive cone, it's a positive inner product. The trace inner product, of course, has that character. The trace of two positive operators is positive. So here's a representation lemma. Subject to axiom 2, I can always find a positive G invariant inner product on V star. That's almost trivial. I mean, if I have a compact group acting on a vector space, there's always an invariant inner product. But how do I make it positive? Well, here's one way to do it. Because of the second part there, the transitivity of G's action on pure states, you can represent the pure states as the space of orbits of it is a space of orbits. You can represent it as as the quotient space G mod K, where K is the stabilizer of any pure state you want, say alpha 0. And if you do that, then any F in V star gives rise to a continuous function on G that way. You know, just fix that reference state, permute it, and apply F. Think of that as a function of G. It's clearly continuous. This gives you an embedding of V star as a G invariant real subspace of the algebra of continuous complex value functions. Pardon me, that should be, that could be complex or real. I don't really care. Let's say real value functions on G. Real subspace. Yeah, look at all the complex functions, but these are going to be real value functions. Now, the restriction of the natural inner product on V star is, in fact, a real G invariant inner product. What is that natural inner product? You all remember this? You take two elements, you convolve them, and then you integrate against R measure. That's an inner product on C of G. When you convolve positive functions, you get a positive function. When you integrate positive functions, you get positive values, these non-negative values. So this inner product is a positive G invariant inner product on C of G, and so it restricts to the same on the image of V star under this embedding. So pull it back, you have a positive invariant inner product. Which, if I ever need to refer to it again, which I'm not sure I do, I'm going to call this inner product given by G. But I'm mostly interested that there be such an inner product. Here's a lemma that, because I've told Bill he's to stop me at 10 o'clock exactly, so you know, to avoid too much damage when that happens, I'm probably not going to give you the proof, but I think you can see by scanning it that it's quite elementary. It's really just sort of easy algebra. Well, I mean, it's elementary. There's nothing fancy going on here. Here's the dilemma. I think this is quite nice, actually. If you give me any positive G invariant inner product on V star, of which I've just shown you that there always is one, but if you give me any such thing, then there's always an embedding of outcomes as vectors, in fact, unit vectors, in V star with respect to this inner product. I mean, V star with respect to this inner product, that's a finite dimensional ordered Hilbert space. And I'm saying you can always embed outcomes as vectors, unit vectors, indeed, in there, in such a way, now this, because of my sloppy preparation, is going to look really bizarre, in such a way that the inner product of Vx and Vy is zero, if and only if x and y are orthogonal. But I actually mean something there that's not just a stupidity. In the literature of test spaces, one often writes x perf y to mean x and y are distinct outcomes belonging to a common test. They can be tested together and are not the same. So what I'm saying here is, darn it, if you have distinct outcomes of any common test, the representing vectors will be orthogonal. So what I'm saying is I can represent the test space as a collection of orthonormal bases in a finite dimensional real Hilbert space. The trick is you basically, what you do, you project everything down to the orthocomplement of the unit vector. You look at the angles. You find that the relevant quantities are negative, and that means that you can kind of subtract a suitable model of the, a suitable multiple of the unit so as to spread things out until they're orthogonal. The key thing is that all of the orthogonal outcomes have a common inner product because of the symmetry assumption. Any two orthogonal outcomes, distinguishable outcomes, can be mapped to any other such pair. Two such pairs belong to two tests. I can find a bijection that sends this pair to this pair. There's a group element that then maps the one to the other. The group, by the way, is by G invariants acting as unitaries on this space, so the inner product is the same. Sorry that that was fast, but it's true. So using the commonality of that angle, the fact that you make a common angle with the unit functional, you have this lovely, if I do say so myself, this lovely little lemma. Here's another lemma. If we let S be the common inner product between any two distinguishable outcomes, then it turns out that after you orthogonalize, think of Vx and Vy as the vectors you get when you go through this orthogonalization procedure, the inner product between the orthogonalized vectors is the original inner product minus this common orthogonal thing. Notice I say here, for all outcomes, right? So if x and y down here happen to be orthogonal, then vx and vy are zero, and so this difference is zero. That just means that you have s, which is, you know, is given. So again, the proof, which I don't have time for, unfortunately, is just an elementary calculation. You can make the slides available, and you can check it if you want to, but it's not hard. Okay. Now, here we come to the half axiom, the infinite axiom. as a bad actor. It would really be nice if S were zero. Short of S being zero, let's agree that a G invariant positive inner product on V star is minimizing if whatever this S is in the previous slide, I guess that's lemma three, this constant value that the inner product takes on orthogonal vectors, call the inner product minimizing if that S is in fact the minimum value the inner product ever takes on any pair of outcomes, so that the distinguishable outcomes are maximally spread out in some sense. That's certainly true for the trace inner product, where this common inner product is zero. The lemma here is that if you have a minimizing inner product, then all of these normalized vectors lie in the positive cone of Vx. That's just an alternative way of saying minimizing. So that the cone generated by these Vx's is contained in the dual cone in V star. Moreover, and very importantly, if you fix Vx and look at the inner product of Vx with whatever you like, that gives you a state. It's not just a state, it turns out it's the unique state that gives the outcome x probability 1. That's a very strong property. I sometimes call that sharpness. If you have minimizing, then not only does every outcome have probability 1 in some state, but that state is unique. And it's given by this inner product. The proof is immediate from lemma 3, but since you haven't followed the proof of lemma 3, we'll just let you think about that later. But it really is straightforward. I promise. Okay, so here's my provisional axiom. There is a minimizing such inner product. How to motivate that? I wish I knew. But it has the feel to me of something that probably has a motivation. I have a feeling that this quantity S means something physical, at least in the case where the inner product is the canonical one coming from the group algebra. Yeah. Oh, so you think so? I should be able to embed this. Oh. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that later, because that's I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good thought. At least I think I hadn't thought of it. Yeah. Well, maybe that's actually okay. Good. That's maybe relevant to something else I was going to say here. I don't know of any examples where this doesn't hold anyway. It holds in every example that I've checked. Moreover, I can prove a theorem that says that if I have a test space with the property that if you give me any two outcomes, there's a third outcome that's orthogonal to both of them. For any two outcomes, there's some outcome that can be tested jointly with either of them. That's enough to force that any positive invariant inner product is going to be minimizing. So there are lots of conditions under which you know you're going to have a minimizing inner product. I don't know any example that isn't. By the way, you can prove that all of the positive inner products on the positive Hermitian operators are minimizing. You can characterize them. There's a nice one-parameter family with the usual trace inner product at one end. They're all minimizing. So it's just distantly conceivable, and maybe your remark suggest this too, that they're all minimizing. Maybe. But even if not, I think that there's some possibility of motivating it. All right. Okay. Hold that thought. Okay. 10 o'clock. Okay. I've answered a lot of questions, so maybe I can count. So thank you to all my questions so far. All right. So here's a proposition. Subject to the axioms listed so far, 1, 2, and this provisional half or infinite axiom 3, this cone here is in fact self-dual. The proof here is short enough that I think maybe I can indicate it. You pick just run through it briefly. You pick a minimizing invariant inner product, courtesy of half axiom 3. There is one. The positivity of that inner product lets you embed the positive cone of the dual in the sort of internal dual, which is isomorphic to the original positive cone. I'm sorry, that's not quite right. That's sort of, which is isomorphic to the internal dual. Now, if you let Vx be the orthogonalized version of X, then this previous lemma tells you that this function this thing thought of as a function on y. It defines a state making x certain, because I said that these were unit vectors. That's part of the content of that lemma. And by axiom three, this is the pure state. I should probably say v sub x there. Follows that every pure state has this form by symmetry. I can commute all the pure states. And so every pure state is represented in this cone. And so this cone is also contained in that one. So the critical step is just this. Well, is this positivity condition that I get from minimization together with this symmetry that lets me permute all the pure states and say that they all look like any one of them. Now, that leaves homogeneity. And I'm going to go through this very quickly. I apologize for the speed with which I'm going to do this, but I do think we need to finish up. Homogeneity turns out to be much easier to motivate than self-duality, which is a little strange because a priori it looks more mysterious. But actually, we know lots of ways to motivate it now. I will probably in the question section want to mention some of them that have come up in work that I've been doing jointly with Howard Barnum. But here, let me sketch one way that's different from that. To do so, I need a quick digression on coupled systems in this test space framework. If you have two test spaces, you can form a sort of Cartesian product test space where you just look at product tests. You just have Alice make measurement E and Bob make measurement F, and they collate their responses, or rather their results. A state omega on that test space is non-signaling if it has well-defined marginal states. If the marginal probability that Bob sees X doesn't depend on what test Alice makes, and likewise in the other direction. Mixtures of product states are clearly, sorry, that should say not influence-free but non-signaling. And you can also show that if the full state spaces are not simplices, there will always exist we certainly want to call entangled non-signaling states that aren't mixtures of product states. So that's really an aside. I do want to note that if you have well-defined marginals, you also have well-defined conditional probabilities on both sides, given a joint state. And those sort of bipartite conditional states satisfy the natural analogs of the laws of total probability. Marginal probability on Alice's side is the sum over any test you like that Bob might make of the probability of Bob's getting a certain outcome Y times the conditional probability on Alice's side given that Bob sees Y. That's just a natural consequence of that definition. And of course, it works symmetrically on the other side. All right, so here's another axiom. This is strong, but again, I think I know what it says. I'm going to say that a non-signaling state is correlating if there are two tests. This is a state, by the way, on two copies of the same system. I'm going to say it's correlating if, for some pair of tests, and some bijection matching the elements of one test with the other, the joint probability of getting anything that of any non-matched pair of outcomes is zero. So that's just a way of saying that this joint state restricted to E cross F is concentrated on the graph of this bijection, that the probability of seeing matched pairs, some matched pair, is one. Right? That's a correlating state. Establishes a perfect correlation between some pair of tests. My third axiom is that every state should show up as the marginal of a correlating state. Now that's strong, but I think I see what it says. Is it satisfied ever? Well, yes, classically it's satisfied pretty trivially. I can always move my probability measure to the diagonal. And it's satisfied a little bit less trivially in quantum systems by the Schmidt decomposition theorem, which essentially says, well, the Schmidt decomposition plus the possibility of purifying. If I take an arbitrary state, I can purify it. The pure entangled state that I get there, but thereby has a Schmidt decomposition, which will, of course, by what you mean by a Schmidt decomposition, correlate to orthonormal bases, hence to tests. There's a nice lemma you can prove that a state that is the marginal of a correlating state is, in a weak sense, spectral. By that I mean that it is the sum of, that is sort of the weighted average of states epsilon sub x. Here my notation, I'm afraid, derives from an earlier slide. That's the unique state making x have probability 1, which we know we have in the current context by the earlier slide. Just the thing that is the inner product of v sub x with something. So the point is that every state has this decomposition into those, maybe we call them indicator states, weighted by the probabilities that alpha assigns to these outcomes in some experiment E, some test E. So analog of the spectral decomposition for density matrices. Okay. Again, the proof I will skip just in the interest of time, but it's not especially hard. Here's my final axiom. I'm going to call this the filtering axiom. This one I think is fairly plausible, actually. It says that for every test and every function on the test taking values between 0 and 1 exclusive of 0, every strictly positive function between 0 and 1 on that test, there should exist some sort of automorphism. This probably should be from V star plus to V star plus, some affine automorphism of the positive cone. Think of that as a physical symmetry of some sort that implements that scaling. So what I'm saying here is that if you give me a single test, and there's some way of attenuating, let's say, attenuating the responsiveness of each outcome, attenuating the sensitivity of each of an array of detectors, maybe, then I should be able to carry that out physically. I should be able to independently and arbitrarily attenuate the responses of outcomes in a test. Certainly, I can do that classically. So this is another example of an axiom that's basically saying, if you look at just one test, it should look classical. In that sense, it should look like a classical test in that sense that you can independently attenuate outcomes at will by some physical automorphism. And reversibly, automorphism means reversibly. That's because I'm assuming that I don't attenuate anything all the way to zero. If you can do this, then you can actually find an automorphism that will take each x in the test to any non-negative constant you like. I'm sorry, any strictly positive constant you like times x. In other words, you can get rid of the upper bound of 1 just by scaling everything appropriately.
So that
I
should say for every x,
but that is for every x in E. Thank you. Yeah, so that is a typo. So this is only for x's in the test E, not for every test, of course, in the whole test space. Well, sure. So here's an example. Suppose that your measurement is to look at an array of detectors, and the detectors are detecting a particle coming from a source that's emitting just one particle at a time, such that, you know, at least in some idealization, you're bound to get a click, just one click, in exactly one of those detectors. You could imagine attenuating the sensitivity of those detectors so that some, you know, making them imperfect, so that one of the detectors might not fire all of the time. Right? You could reduce its sensitivity. And then you get something that's not quite a full measurement because sometimes it fails to work. But that's still all right. That actually happens. So all I'm saying is that you should be able to do that in some physical way independently on each of your detectors. You should be able to reduce the, you know, turn down the gain a little bit. Not to zero, but, you know, if anything else, independently on each of the detectors, think of each one as having a little knob, reversibly, because you can, you know, turn up the gain as well. All I'm saying is that you should be able to do that physically by some physical automorphism of the state space. And if you don't like that particular model, then I will again say, classically, you can do this. Classical probability says, I can do this. There's an automorphism that will let me do this. So if I really insist that everything should really look classical, one test at a time, then I should be able to do this. Okay. If you grant me all of the axioms to this point, you can prove the cone is homogeneous. The proof involves really just using this sort of toy spectral theorem. You take any two elements of the interior of the cone, you give them their spectral decompositions, their interior, so these coefficients are non-zero. And since they're non-zero, these ratios are non-zero and positive, because this is a positive inner product. These ratios are positive, you get these positive coefficients, and you can find an automorphism that multiplies everything by those coefficients. And you just work through the algebra, and you see that with an appropriate group element to match things up properly, you can map the one element of your cone to the other. Okay, so that gives you homogeneity. And I apologize for talking at such length. And I apologize to Bill, because I did tell Bill that he should absolutely stop me at 10 o'clock. And, you know, I knew full well that wasn't really likely to happen. So once again, I apologize for my manifest dishonesty at almost every point in this talk. I hope you will forgive me. Thank you. And also for coffee?
And then coffee.
Oh.
18 minutes for questions. Okay. Then coffee.
Okay.
What's the question? Did I just text before? I'd like to ask you for sure.
There was a professional three and then a three.
Oh, well, that's the problem. Okay, so I've misnumbered, in addition to everything else, I've misnumbered my axioms. So the reason you missed it is that it wasn't there.
I guess my question, yeah. Each stage of axiom one, you define a set of probability measures on a set of outcomes. Yeah. So you can already define an order in that stage, probability of one outcome is always a probability of another outcome. You could say that there's already an order.
Yes, yes.
So maybe have a structure where you can then ask for that ordering is the same on the cone.
Yeah, although actually the homogeneity condition that I imposed is axiom 2, which says that every outcome can be mapped to every other outcome by a symmetry of the whole system, is going to enforce that all of the outcomes are at the same level in that order.
Okay. Well, so in a way, you've got S axiom 0 that in the first place says a non perfection.
I would say that's a definition. But in fact, I don't think that that's a big deal, because if you start giving me contextual probability weights, what I'm going to say is, well, that's just indicating that there's some outcome of test E and test F that you really shouldn't have identified in the first place. You made a mistake in building your model. Really, those are two different outcomes, and you should have listed them as different outcomes in the first place.
Alexa, you have a sort of philosophical thing. Question. This very much resembles to me Magnus' work. I mean, apparently, the framework, of course, is not exactly Magnus, but the way you formulate mathematical axioms, this is very much like a Magnus. So what is really the new element for you? Like, what is the element that gives us new understanding compared to Magnus with his own?
Right. Well, first of all, the comment is very well taken. I think you're right. I think that the spirit of this is the spirit of Mackey's work. I think the mathematical idiom is very similar to that of Mackey. But the axioms are different. And speaking broadly, symmetry is not something that was part of Mackey's axiomatic. He did not impose symmetry constraints. And this correlation axiom is also very foreign to the kind of work that was done by Mackey and his successors, who tended to focus entirely on the structure of just a single system. One of the things that I think the last decade or so has taught us, and I think this is largely owing to impetus from quantum information theory, is that it's a mistake to focus entirely on the structure of single systems, or at least that one is possibly missing very useful information that one might have if one were to back up a moment and consider systems in interaction. So that axiom is more modern in that way in spirit. I think the independent attenuation axiom, that's similar to things people have considered before, even thinking back in the 60s. And certainly this benign first axiom is basically one of Mackey's axioms. But the symmetry and the correlation axioms are new.
The correlation axiom is again, I mean, I wonder if it could be derived from some kind of quantum labor or some of your better axioms, like the symmetry axiom. So in particular, you didn't say anything about transformation. So I wonder about
between two systems, you mean?
A change of those dynamics.
Yeah, that's right.
But what I wonder was whether your symmetry group that you introduced over the state space could be assumed to also be something that could be achieved dynamically.
Well, I guess I would be inclined to say that you would model the dynamics in terms of the symmetry group and look at one parameter subgroups of that compact group.
So in that case, then maybe the correlation axiom could be replaced by an axiom, which is sort of another kind of symmetry between time-like correlations and space-like correlations, show a general density-type axiom. And then the existence of an identity map would get you something
That's actually very, very interesting. I mean, the more so in view of some things that Mauro will talk about, I think, on Saturday, since he uses precisely a kind of Troika-Lukowski axiomatic framework. I hadn't considered something quite that specific, but one thing that I have often wondered and have sort of been meaning to get around to tackling and just haven't yet, is ask what extra mileage one can get if one assumes that the group G, this sort of group of physical symmetries, isn't just any old compact group, but a compact Lie group, which is certainly reasonable, you know, a reasonable thing to consider if you're looking at reasonable physical models. So maybe, you know, having that additional structure would enable one to do something along the lines of your proposal. I don't know, but I know that.
Why do you need a Lie group to replace the correlation? You just say whatever group it is, demand and try to assume that the dynamics for all those groups are possible. And try
to ask
something that's
isomorphic
identity.
Yeah, maybe I don't. But it reminds you.
They give you more symmetry.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, what I was thinking, I guess, I mean, it's just that you're kind of reminded of this thought, I suppose. That if I have this Lie structure, then of course I have the Lie algebra of the group, and there's probably some story to be told about the way the Jordan algebras emerge from this axiomatic and that Lie structure. What that story is, I don't really know, but I suspect there is such a story. I don't know. And actually, the broader question of which your question is sort of an instance or a special case is, you know, are these axioms all independent of each other? And how strong are they? I mean, all I've said is that these axioms imply that you have a homogeneous self-dual cone. I haven't said that absolutely every homogeneous self-dual cone satisfies these axioms. So on the one hand, it may be that these axioms are strong enough that they actually get us further than I've taken us. And if that's so, then it may be possible to weaken them and still get as much mileage out of them as it has, if one wanted to back away from quantum mechanics a little bit. And it's certainly possible that they're not independent.
So these particular correlation
axioms
are very easy to understand,
and yet
all this is quite strong.
Yeah. Well, I guess this whole exercise was motivated. I'm going to pick a little bit on Mauro. It was motivated when I read Mauro's one of his papers in which he was saying, well, you know, every approach has some strong, you know, axiom in it, and so I sort of said, okay, I'm going to give myself permission to make some strong axioms after 20 or so years. I'm going to give myself permission to play a little bit. So I did.
Yeah, I was wondering whether, because there's some idea of dynamics and little between some of the axioms, so whether it would make sense to start with like an axiomatic which actually takes it down, but it sort of relates me to Phillips thought, who sort of assumed like the best case steps to be the compositional element in force being emitted because the claims are in the space.
Yeah, I missed a lot of talks. So apologies to all of the talks I have people to talk about.
So whether you could actually build this even earlier than the level of the axiomatic framework, as well as the correlation, actually, mm-hmm. whether you could actually build this in as a compositional structure in your axiomatic start.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think these are good suggestions. Just to repeat what I said a moment ago, my sort of working assumption had been that once I got the kinematical structure in place, then the dynamical structure would just follow in the usual way by looking at one parameter subgroups of the physical symmetry group. But you know, that's not the only way to play the game. It probably would be interesting to look at whether one can approach this dynamics first point of view.
Five axioms you laid down got you to homogeneous self-dual cones. So do you have ideas for how to get rid of the undivided
No, not at the moment. Unless possibly one could show that these axioms are strong enough to kill off one or another. In fact, they might very well be strong enough to kill off the exceptional, you know, 3x3 things over the Eptonians. Isis. Well, I don't know. You know, all of these formerly real Jordan algebras, for example, have a spectral theorem, sort of how you prove things about them. So an obvious task that I haven't yet undertaken, one respect in which this is incomplete, is to go and look at spin factors in particular and ask if they satisfy these axioms. It's pretty clear that the others do, the quantum ones do. But I don't know if the spin factors do.
Exceptional Jordan algebra, the Jordan product can't be represented.
Yeah, it's not. It's, exactly. That's right. It's exceptional.
Is it not?
Exactly.
It's a one half.
It's exceptional, but it's not special.
Where does the strong desire to kill off those extra two?
I don't have a super strong desire.
I mean, it's not as if anyone has ever tested for them.
Right. Right. I think I think that there's a sort of lingering suspicion that the spin factors in particular might have some very reasonable physical manifestation. It might not be quantum mechanics, but
the fellow who, you want to give kick out of the party.
Well, I don't know.
What's wrong with him?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think there are some people who would say absolutely nothing. He's, the hero of the savior of particle physics. But what do I know? I don't know about such things. Leave that to wiser heads.
I have another question for you, but it's really ridiculous.
Good.
So I think you should take serious questions first.
Are there any more serious questions?
it is a ridiculous one, but for some reason it rose
right to
my head. Okay, go ahead. Anything whatsoever. Okay. What would Hillary Clinton think about your axioms?
today or tomorrow? Wait.
Well, I'm just curious.
I had a better answer. Let's rewind the clock. Ask me the question again.
No, seriously. What would Hillary Clinton think of your axioms?
Today or tomorrow? I've been told that he's become a fairly convinced Bohmian. So I think what Hillary Putnam would, I can't do this now. If you remember the very first slide where I said there's two ways to be puzzled by quantum mechanics, it's that first way where you say quantum mechanics is a dynamical theory, god damn it, and I'll just somehow shoehorn the probabilities in to make all of that work. All of the standard interpretational, all of the things that go by the names of interpretations of quantum mechanics start from that point of view, I believe. And certainly, a Bohmian would get off the train at that stop and might even be willing to go so far as to say, no, it's not really a probability theory primarily. It's primarily a dynamical theory. The density operator or the state vector, that's an actual physical field of some sort. And it's only that the dynamics in the long run sort of pushes things around so that it sort of appears that the statistics is to a good approximation given by the Born rule.
I'm glad you bring this up, though. What makes Hillary a little interesting, and consequently disappointing, was that he's made the transition from number two back up.
Yeah.
Not back up to number one, but from number two, something like number two, up to number one.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess to pinpoint my question a little more, it must be that you would find something unappealing about the development, any development of the flavor of number two, yours being one example.
I don't know. I think what he might say is that number two is sort of unexceptionable but unexciting. I think a lot of people take the view that a principle theory approach to understanding quantum mechanics, is all very well and good, but why should we bother with that if there's some constructive approach? Your principle theory might be perfectly correct, but it's somehow less explanatory than my constructive approach. So, you know, I wish you good luck with it, but don't expect me to come to your talks. My own view is, I guess that, first of all, I don't find these constructive approaches very persuasive. So I have occasionally been tempted with that. A confession I'll make public. Every once in a while, I think the Bohmian mechanics is kind of pretty. I hope you won't decide that I don't get my scotch.
I'll be honest.
Okay.
But maybe not.
Okay. 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 But I keep coming back to the following idea. When you look at the theory of whether it be density operators and POVMs on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, or whether it be states on von Neumann algebras, this structure really does function as a generalized probability theory. It really does function as one that, from the perspective of these much more general models I've talked about, looks remarkably close to being classical. It's got all sorts of special features that are of a classical flavor. It's not more non-classical than it might be. It's less non-classical than it might be. And for some reason, it's a model that nature seems to take very seriously in an abundance of different situations that don't necessarily look like they're physically the same kind of thing. That really does suggest to me that what we're looking at is not something that is so much like the statistical mechanics of some underlying dynamical theory we haven't found yet, but is something that's a little bit more like probability theory per se. Or if you want to back away from that a little bit, it's a little bit like maybe the theory of the normal distribution. I mean, think about how the normal distribution must have looked initially. People did at one point even contemplate that maybe it reflected some mysterious occult force that sort of pushed things to be normal. And it's only later that we realize that no, it's just purely a mathematical fact. That there are characterizations of the normal distribution that make it abundantly clear that whatever the underlying dynamics is, you should expect lots of things much of the time to be normal or approximately so. And the situation with quantum mechanics, and this is only a guess, has to me the flavor of that kind of situation. Whether this is, the best characterization of quantum probabilities, I doubt. It's certainly not the only possibility, but I wouldn't expect there to be one, unique best characterization, just as there are many ways to characterize normal distributions or any other family of distributions you like. I think the idea is to find characterizations that will give us some reason to give us some sense that we understand why we should have expected nature to be like this in the first place, at least in certain parts. I don't know if that very long-winded answer was adequate to the absurdity of your question.
Exactly the sort of thing I wanted.
Okay, good. So I'm happy to hear that. Thank you. Questions or coffee? I vote for coffee.